You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sick of those trivia podcasts that you don't even understand how to operate and they just have too many levers and buttons?
There's got to be a better way.
Now there is, with Good Job Brain, an offbeat quiz show and trivia podcast that makes learning new things easy and fun.
I just learned that artificial vanilla flavoring sometimes comes from the anal glands of a beaver, and now I can never shake that mental image. Thanks, Good Job Brain.
Good Job Brain is available for the low price of just 4 easy payments of free. It's a podcast.
Good Job Brain is part of Airwave Media and available on all podcast apps. Operators are standing by.
For 16 years, three-time NBA champion Dwayne Wade has dazzled basketball fans with his on-court artistry and has built his personal brand into one of the most powerful ones in sports. Now Wade takes readers inside his fascinating life and career in his new photo memoir, Dwayne. And today, Dwayne Wade comes on the podcast to discuss the game that put him on the map when Marquette University beat top seed Kentucky, what it was like to represent his country on the Redeem Team during the 2008 Summer Olympics, and how he, LeBron James, and Chris Bosh became the Big Three on the Miami Heat. He talks about returning to his hometown of Chicago to play for the Bulls, his brief stint playing for the Cavaliers, and why he wanted to finish his career playing for the team that made him. He also shares how the death of his longtime agent, Hank Thomas, influenced his decision to return to Miami, and how he prepared himself for life after basketball. Plus, Dwayne talks pregame rituals, the secret to a good head fake, and black fatherhood. Coming up with Dwayne Wade in just a moment. Dwayne Wade played in the NBA from 2003 to 2019, most notably for the Miami Heat for 15 seasons. He was selected as an NBA All-Star 13 times, won 3 NBA championships, and was named the 2006 NBA Finals Most Valuable Player. He is the Heat's all-time leader in points, games played, assists, and steals, and the NBA's all-time leader for blocks by a guard. These days, he's a regular analyst for TNT's Tuesday night NBA coverage. He spends his time giving back through the Wade Family Foundation, and he heads up a wide range of business ventures, from wine to movies. Not only that, but he's written a new photo memoir. It's called Dwayne. Dwayne Wade, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate the intro.
Oh, you bet. You know, Dwayne, you only just retired from basketball a couple of seasons ago, and it sounds like you're keeping busy as ever. What's the adjustment to civilian life been like?
Civilian life. I like the way you put that. First of all, Ben, thank you for having me on to talk about my book. Civilian life has been challenging, like everyone, you know, like everyone else's, you know, going through obviously a tough time in this last year. But from a standpoint of retiring 2 years ago and trying to find the next phase or that second act in my life, I've been able to kind of jump right in. And I couldn't be happier. I couldn't feel more blessed to have the opportunity to continue to still keep going once the game ends. And I'm just super excited for, you know, what's next, and to be able to be on here, to be able to have this platform that you've given me as well. You know, this definitely helps all that. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, I was impressed because in your book, you say in here, when you retired, I never dreaded life after basketball because I was always preparing for it while I was still playing basketball. So, you know, many players, not just basketball, but any sport, they just totally lose themselves when they leave the game. They don't know how to fill that hole. They lose their sense of purpose. Maybe they don't have strong relationships to help them through that transition. For you, was it as clear as, okay, these things are my new purpose. I know what my goals are. This is what I'm going to do. Or was it more a case of, you know, sort of idle hands or the devil's play thing? So I'm going to keep myself really busy post basketball and just kind of figure it out along the way.
Yeah, great question. Being one of the lucky ones, there's so many different ways to lead the game of basketball. I was able to lead the game with three championship rings, right? So I got kicked out the door and I was able to leave with my rings. And so I came out a little leg up on a champion, a winner, right? Coming to this next world. You know, some guys get, you know, they out in 5 years. Some guys don't, you know, have that to come out of the NBA with. And so where they starting at is maybe different from where I started at. So I definitely understand the privilege and the success I had in sport. But I say all that to say, it's still hard. I've been playing basketball since I was, you know, 5 years old. I fell in love with the game at 9. This is what I know. This is what I became great at. I didn't have time to do a lot of other things really well. I had a great team that helped me start building businesses. But you know, I'm great at basketball and everything else is now I have to learn over again. So first thing I did was sit down and look at myself in the mirror and say, you have to work on you. And so I hired a vocal coach to try to work on me, to try to give myself more confidence. If I'm going to do TV, if I'm going to, you know, go out here and talk about a book that I was trying to create, I hired a therapist. I needed somebody to sit down and talk to when it came to where am I going to put all this anger and this rage that I have on 3-4 nights a week that I can let out on this court? Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to let it out on the ones closest to me, which is on my loved ones. And so now I need to put that energy and these thoughts and these passions somewhere else. Right. And so it's not easy. And it's very hard, you know, when you are 20 some years old, you go through a whole career and by the time you're 35 to 40 is over and it's like, OK, now you're starting all over again. It's very hard when most people are in the prime of their lives. And this is the best that they, you know, they built themselves all the way here and they're rolling at this age. And now you're starting over.
Yeah, it's got to be kind of a transition. And I like what you said about how if you don't have someone to talk to or a therapist, you know, all that rage that goes into playing on the court, you're going to take it out on the people closest to you just by sheer proximity. And now you mentioned that you got into the game at 9. I think it was your dad who first got you into basketball.
Yeah.
You came from the South Side of Chicago. You say that the South Side in here, it's a rough place, but it's also, it gets a little bit of a bad rap in the media. Now, tell us a little about 59th and Prairie and the neighborhood that you grew up in as a boy.
Yeah, 59th and Prairie also is my production company name as well. I grew up there on the South Side of Chicago, you know, just a young kid who, you know, loved his mother. And growing up in the community of the drug infested neighborhood that I grew up in, right, the gang infested neighborhood, you know, at the time for me, that was just the way of life. I didn't see nothing wrong with it. It was just life, like not having food certain days or not having your lights or not have. This is just a part of life. And so you learn how to cope. You learn how to navigate. You learn how to become whatever you need to become. So early in my life, I just was becoming, you know, whatever I needed to be to survive. And, you know, I give my family a lot of credit. They try to protect me as much as possible. They try to cover me. They try to support my dreams as much as they could, which allowed me to be able to be here at this moment talking to you about this journey. And so one of my favorite photos in this book is in the first chapter when you open up. It's a photo of the house I grew up in on 59th and Prairie. That shows me where I started. And it shows me, you know, to never give up, to always continue to understand that there's other little Dwaynes out there that are in that same place. And I know that I use people that, you know, that are doing something in life to give me motivation, you know, to give me inspiration. And I'm trying to still become that, you know, for plenty of generations.
So you started out pretty early. And of course, Coach Tom Crean lured you over to Marquette for college.
It didn't take a lot of luring.
Yeah, it sounded like, yeah. Tell us about that first meeting.
My first meeting with Coach Crean, you know, what I remember most, and I talk about it in this book, is he brought a cap and gown to the meeting. Something as simple as that. He had bigger dreams than me than just coming in and being a basketball player. He was like, son, I want to see you graduate. I want to see you do something with your life. He came into my community. He knew how I was living. He wanted to see me become better, to better my surroundings. And it wasn't just the MBA. It was the education that I had the opportunity to get at Marquette. It was the relationships that I was going to have the opportunity to be able to build. And so I would never forget feeling like this man wants more for my life than even I at this point, because I never thought about graduating college. I just started thinking about going to college. I didn't even think it was something possible for me. It was a possibility at all. And so that relationship that still goes on to this day is someone that I respect, you know, someone who became a father figure to me at a very rough age and in very sensitive time in my life as a young kid. He really helped guide me. So I definitely talk about those stories and Marquette stories in this book as well.
Mm-hmm. You first emerged on a lot of people's radar during that big game against top-seeded Kentucky in the Elite Eight. 29 points, 11 rebounds, 11 assists, and of course, that breakaway dunk. Even today, you say people still come up to you and want to talk about that game, huh?
First of all, a lot of people from Kentucky. I run into a lot of people.
They give you a lot of crap about that?
Oh, they give me a lot of crap. I ran into Ashley Judd before at an event, and she gave me crap. For everywhere I go, but it's something that we share. You know, we share a conversation about a huge moment in my life, but only one moment in my life. And, you know, then you don't know all the people that you will have affected in any way. And so to be able to have those conversations about what was one of the most important games of my life, that game set my life on a path that it eventually, you know, led down. And that, you know, I always say Pat Riley went to Kentucky and Pat Riley drafted me. Like it mattered. And to be able to like take down Goliath like that as David, as a small school, man, that felt good. And it always feels good. And I love when people come up to me on the street or anywhere and say, hey, that Kentucky game. I say, yes, let's talk about that 29-11-11 game.
Yeah. I think you say it's your favorite moment. Now, you, of course, got drafted to Miami Heat in 2003. And one thing that you talk a lot about in this book is mentorship, players taking each other under their wings, paying it forward. Who was the big influence on you during that rookie season?
I had a lot of guys, Ben, that was a big influence. I talk about Caron Butler, who is now, he's assistant coach in Miami. Shout out to my brother, Caron. He was only 1 year older than me. He was drafted a year before me as the 10th pick. So he had experience that I did not have. He set me down and he gave me what I call the game. He taught me the things I needed to do to make sure that, you know, pretty much the person that I was did not get lost in a sense. And also to Lamar Odom. Lamar Odom, who came from the LA Clippers, who was my vet my rookie year. He was 24 years old. He was my vet. He sat down and gave me a different kind of game. And the game that he gave me is the highs and lows of life and the ups and downs of this sport. And how, you know, that is life, right? And once again, how the sport and life and how it, you know, it continues to be, this is how, you know, sport is how I get to my experiences in life and how I learn about life. I learn through sport. And so, you know, just sitting there and listening to the veteran guys that's been in the league, that's dealt with things that you have no idea what's coming, to be able to help you, to be able to move you when you're about to make a left, when you need to make a right. All those things for me was so important, you know, getting drafted by Miami early on with vets like Caron and Lamar.
Yeah, and this book is so filled with, A, great photos, great stories, and a lot of kind of the big seminal moments in your life. You definitely seem to have an appreciation for these kind of bucket list moments, these things that you'll never forget. Like, of course, the Redeem Team, 2008 Summer Olympics. You led the United States basketball team in scoring and helped them capture the gold. That must have felt like a lot of pressure to have to go in there and literally redeem your own country after that humiliating loss in 04. What was that moment like?
Yeah, that was, that's when pressure and opportunity, it's when it meets. And we're some of the best athletes in the world. So it's not pressure. It's just an opportunity. It's an opportunity to gain respect back for the game of basketball in the U.S. We lost a lot of respect. And it wasn't just by losing. It was the way that we were perceived in a way maybe we handled some things, right? And we had to go back and we had to earn our respect. And we earned it every day. We didn't just earn it on the court. We earned it by going out and supporting all sports. You know, we wasn't just a big, bad U.S. Olympic team no more. We wanted to go out and be a part of everyone and everything. And so we had to rebrand and rebuild. And it was a redeem, you know, kind of mentality. And on the court, we took care of business. And so to be able to play the game of basketball with an idol like Kobe Bryant of mine, to be able to play at that time with one of my very best friends before he became my teammates, Chris Bosh and LeBron James, to be able to play with Chris Paul, one of my good friends, like all these guys, all these great players, and to be able to put all our egos and check them in a box and bring, you know, everything together and be able to win that gold medal. It was special. It's one of the most special moments of my career. And so to be able to come off the bench and add a little something to the team to help us win it all, I will always talk about that. And I always smile for having that opportunity and be thankful.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
American history is full of infamous people, places, and events. If you've ever wanted to know the true story of the Salem witch trials or the 1919 World Series baseball scandal, known as the Black Sox scandal, or hear about the masterful escape attempts from Alcatraz prison or the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle, or hear the crazy details of gangsters, assassins, and thieves like D.B. Cooper, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, John Wilkes Booth, and Lee Harvey Oswald, join me on the Infamous America podcast. I'm your host, Chris Wimmer, and on this podcast, you'll get the in-depth, true stories of some of the darker and more controversial chapters of American history. The stories are all told with cinematic music and sound design, and there are already more than 100 episodes waiting for you to binge. Subscribe or follow the Infamous America podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon Music, or wherever you're listening now.
I'm Brian Keating, host of the Into the Impossible podcast and the Chancellor's Distinguished Professor of Physics at UC San Diego, where I study the origin and evolution of the universe. I believe scientists are obligated to explain our work in simple terms to non-experts, so I created the free university you can attend in your pajamas, taught by the world's brightest faculty. Best of all, you won't incur a dime of student loan debt, and there's no homework to complete. Every week, I put out a deep dive interview with important thinkers and authors like Andy Weir, Steven Pinker, and Michio Kaku. I've talked to 9 Nobel Prize winners like Sir Roger Penrose and Frank Wilczek, and talked to a few astronauts. I'm on a mission to magnify curiosity, stoke imagination, and inspire minds of all ages. Join me, because the only way to discover the limits of the possible is to go beyond them, into the impossible.
Yeah, and speaking of bringing a lot of talent onto one team, I have to ask you about the big three. You, LeBron, and Chris Bosh. You changed the game when you all came together on the same team. 4 consecutive NBA finals, 2 back-to-back championship wins. Can you give us sort of the inside story on how the big three actually came to be?
I feel like we all have our own versions, probably, first of all, right? You know, but in my version, and I talk about it, you know, my documentary, I talk about it in my book, you know, just once 2010 came, I feel that we, all three of us separately, was just in different spaces of where we wanted to be. And I think that all the spaces and all the roads led to ultimately we wanted to win. I had already won. And once you win, now you want to feel that again. So I wanted to get back to that. LeBron hadn't won yet. And, you know, he's one of the greatest players in the game at that point. And he's trying to accomplish something that's bigger than most guys could even envision. He needs to win, right? Chris Bosh is, you know, in Toronto, and he's becoming a very good player, but no one really recognizes. So how about coming to Miami and get on that stage where we all had our different reasons why? And just to be able to make that decision, to be able to sit down, look across from each other as 3 young, you know, Black men at that time in the NBA, to be able to make a decision and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. We know we're going to shift the culture and change the culture of the way that the game has been perceived. But we want to do this because this is what we want to do. And the ultimate goal is to win. And that's our only agenda. And so we went out there and accomplished it.
Yeah, you sure did. That was a huge moment for the game. But at the time, there was so much blowback from basketball fans. I mean, people were actually saying that the big three ruined the game. Were you guys a little surprised at all the haters that came out of the woodwork there?
Yes, Ben. Yes, we were. We could prepare for a lot of things, but we could not prepare for the hate. Like, if you ever seen hatred on someone's face, it's an ugly thing. And as 3 young men who love to play the game of basketball, who are friends, who want to play the game together, to get hate because we took our own destiny in our own, you know, in our own control, it was a little mind-boggling to us. And so that turned us to try to be people that we wasn't either, right? We tried to play into the villain role. And that's not why we all became teammates. We became teammates because we love the game of basketball. We want to win at the highest level, and we wanted to be damn good doing it, right? We wanted to look good doing it. And we played that first year with hatred on our shoulders and in our hearts and in our mind. And it wasn't a fun year of basketball. But eventually, no one likes change. No one likes change. change. And people will kick and scream their way out of change. But the game has now evolved. And we were just lucky enough to be in that pinnacle moment to be able to shift the game. And now the players have taken it and the power is in the players' hands. And you know, you have to respect that and love that because they are the ones and we are the ones who make the game.
And you guys certainly proved all the haters wrong. I want to talk to you about your pregame rituals a little bit. You say in here that going around the arena, doing pull-ups on the rim, that was all kind of for the fans. But what goes on inside your head before tip-off? What's that mental preparation like?
Pregame, as you see how I set my book up, I set it up with pregame. Then I went first, second, third, fourth, and postgame, right? I set it up. And I wanted to take the fans into the mentality of me as an athlete and how I thought about the pregame and what that meant. And so for me, pregame was really just going through a checklist of everything that I needed to make sure that I was as confident as I needed to be by the time the game came. And so pregame was all going through my mental checklist of, hey, you know, am I stretching? Am I activating my muscles? You know, am I working on the shots that I'm going to shoot tonight? Have I went over the plays? Have I looked at film? Like, it's just a mental check for me. And when I got on that court, the last thing I needed to do was run around and raise the crowd up because that was the last thing I needed everybody to get up and give me that energy, give our team that energy and that love because we're going to need you guys that night. And I want everybody to feel it from me. And that was the last thing I would do before we would play the game of basketball.
I also want to ask you about the Dwayne Wade move, as they call it. You are the master of head fakes. And like I said, people call it the Dwayne Wade move, but you actually give credit to Sam Cassell, who actually played with the Bucks when you were at Marquette. What's the secret of a good head fake?
I don't think it's one secret. And first of all, shout out to Sam Cassell. I always give him respect because I watched him do it for so many years and I wasn't a great shooter. And so I needed to be able to have some other tool in my bag if I was going to be able to have defenders thinking and questioning stuff. So I adapted it to my game. And the reason I was able to adapt it as not a great shooter is because I was quick enough, strong enough to beat my defenders and get them to work very hard to try to cut me off. And once I stopped on a dime, now your job is to come back and contest my shot. You don't want to give me an open shot. And so I used my shot fake at that moment as my defender tried to come back and lunge at me as an opportunity to keep them off their feet and not knowing what I was going to do. And so it became a big tool for me that I think the NBA has now gotten rid of. And so I'm glad I'm retired and I'm out of there because I'd average like 3 points a game.
Yeah, man. After having so much time playing for the Heat, you do a season and a half at Chicago and then Cleveland. Now, Chicago, I get, you know, for a kid growing up, you know, on the South Side, watching Jordan and Pippen and all that. I mean, that must have been a bucket list type of thing. But you always said that you would never play for the Cavaliers. And then you go to Cleveland. And I think you even give this section of the book the headline, "What I Was Thinking." So tell me, Dwayne, what were you thinking?
First of all, never say never. How about that? I was thinking two things. I was going through a tough spot in my life as my agent, Henry Thomas, was sick. And the love for the game of basketball for me started fading away. The business started to get ugly. After I had to leave Miami, I started to really see the business of the game. And so me going to Cleveland was one to rejoin back up with LeBron. LeBron sat down with me. He asked me to come. He knew that, you know, of my talents. And, you know, even though I was older, he knew the things that I could bring as a leader. He wanted me to come. So, yeah, to be able to go and enjoy the game again with a friend of mine who was the best player in the game at that point, I wanted to be a part of that. And also, too, to be able to win a championship, to be able to play for. You know, at that point in my career, what else am I playing for? I already got 3 rings. I've already accomplished everything. So I might as well go out here and try to compete. And LeBron has, at that point, probably been in the finals 7 or 8 times in a row. So let me go jump on this bandwagon for a minute. And we had a good time. We had a fun time and the time I was there. But it wasn't a team that was going to win the championship for the Cavaliers. And they realized that. And so I'm forever thankful for the organization, the GM, Kobe, for asking me, do you want to go back to Miami? For putting together a deal to send me back home to end my career. So I'm appreciative of my time in Cleveland. They were great to me.
Better to you than the word of LeBron, I suppose. You talk a lot about all the crap that he got when he left for the Heat. For you, though, you know, you had a very different experience. It sounds like when you went to Chicago and Cleveland for that season and a half, the fans weren't really angry at you in Miami. You say that they were actually kind of asking you to come back and actually really missed you. That must have been a nice homecoming when you finally came back.
Yeah, it was great, Ben. They've always treated me like family. And you know how family is. Sometimes family argue. Sometimes family don't see each other for a while. But family come back together. And that's what we did. And so it was no love lost. It's just the business of the game gets a little nasty sometimes. And it's emotions involved in that on both sides and all sides. And so once the emotions clear and the smoke clear, we're forever connected. We're forever connected. And I think, you know, they know that. I know that. We feel that. And so anytime I go back, it's all love. You know, that's Wake County forever.
Your return to Miami was also right around the time that your longtime agent, who you just mentioned, Hank Thomas, passed away. You describe him in here as almost sort of a second father to you. Talk about the role that he played in your life, both on and off the court.
Yeah. Coming into this world, Ben, I come from a tough background. I come from, you know, what people would call a broken family, from the sense of, from the standard way that family's supposed to family. Right. And once I got drafted, you know, my family, my parents were going down their own addictions and their own journeys in life. And I didn't really have, you know, anyone besides my college coach really, you know, really there from the standpoint of that has lived this life, has been in this life that could help me grow. And I can go to and ask questions to. And so Hank became that guy. He became the guy that took care of the needs that I needed with my family back in Chicago. He was the one that I went to when I had relationship issues, being a married man in the NBA at the age of 21 years old, just all these things. And so he became a very important figure and role in my life. I became a very important figure and role in his life as well. So losing him at that time while in Cleveland, I was done with basketball. I think they seen it. I felt it. I didn't want to play basketball anymore. And I definitely didn't want to play there anymore as things were kind of, you know, it wasn't fun no more. You know, we all of our jokes was old to each other now. No one was having a good time. We were losing and it wasn't good. And so when I got that call to go back to Miami, I think that's the only thing that gave me a little bit more life to finish that year out. And I was going to retire after that season because I didn't want to play anymore. What Hank and I shared was something so special in basketball. I didn't have that anymore and I didn't want to play it anymore. So it was a tough time for me, very dark time for me. But coming back to Miami lifted my spirit some.
And after you retired, we already talked a little bit about kind of your post-basketball life. You have, I don't know how many different ventures that you're involved in. You're a busy man, it seems. You know, I wonder, are there lessons that you've learned in basketball that have served you well in business as you're expanding your brand and taking on this new chapter in your life?
Oh, yes. Everything. Everything I learned to be even classify as a successful athlete, I utilize and I apply today. And, you know, and it's the basic things as in respect people's time, find a routine, you know what I mean? Work together very well as a team. Like, you know, what you're trying to accomplish in sport, you have to work so well together with other individuals from different places, different mindsets, you know, different ages, different, you know, coming from different backgrounds. And everything that I learned in sport, I bring to this world. I try to apply the same things. I try to apply the same respect to the craft of trying to become a businessman, understanding that I'm behind the eight ball. I didn't go to school for this, but if I can be myself out here, if I can just be Dwyane Wade, it'll be easier for me to be a businessman because I'm doing things that I'm passionate about and that I love to do. So yes, sport, and like I continue to say, in life, lessons are what I teach my kids and what I use as metaphors for my kids' lives as well.
Yeah, good for you. And you talk at length about your kids, your love for them, how your daughter was a large part of the reason you retired from the game, the role that your own father has played in your life and still does, and specifically about the challenges and blessings of being a Black parent. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yes. I mean, I've been a parent my whole life. I'm 39. I got a 19-year-old who turned 20 in a couple months. I've been a parent my entire life, and it's been nothing but a blessing. I, you know, I always tell Zaire when I became his father, it gave me real purpose and it gave me my why to not give up and to not quit. But it's a lot of challenges that come with being a young parent and a young father and a father, you know, in a community that, you know, you don't see a lot of fathers or you don't see a lot of parents parenting together. I didn't grow up with a lot of positive influence in fathering space. I felt my dad did as amazing of a job as he could. And he lacked in a lot of areas, like I lack in a lot of areas, where, right? And so for me, you know, I feel that one of my purposes on this earth, Ben, is I was put on this earth to be a father, right? That's one of my main purposes on this earth. And I fell short in a lot of areas in life, but that's one that I'm trying to get right. And, you know, my kids mean everything to me from the standpoint of, you know, every day I get up, I'm getting up because I'm trying to lead by example and not be that person who just talks about what he wants to do and what, you know, what he wants for their future. I'm trying to lead by example through mine and help them navigate through theirs. And it's an everyday journey because, once again, I'm the one who's doing it. I'm the first one in the family to be here. And so it's hard. it's a tough journey.
Yeah, yeah. But I can tell from the book, I can tell from the photos and the descriptions and everything that you're obviously a tight-knit bunch over there. So you're killing it. You're doing great. And it's not easy, Lord knows. Before we go, I have to ask, what's next up for Dwayne?
This book tour is up next.
Okay.
I've been planning this for, I've been writing this for 3 years. And, you know, I feel that it's stories in this book. But it's moments in here that certain photos would take me through a journey that I will be able to share with others that hopefully inspires and hopefully, help others think about things a certain way or cope with things a certain way or say, no, he's crazy. I'm going to do it this way. Right. Whatever the case may be. So I'm going to continue to try to do all the things that, that is provided for me to be able to do. Being an entrepreneur is something that, I am. And I will continue to try to learn how to become the best one possible. But in the midst of it, just try to continue to live life and let life be the work.
Well, good for you. Good for you, man. People got to get this book. Great photos, great stories. It's called Dwayne, comes out November 16th. Dwayne Wade, thanks for talking with me, man.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Dwayne Wade for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Dwayne, on Amazon or wherever books are sold, and follow him on Twitter at Dwayne Wade. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at Kickass News Pod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Kickass News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.